Because it mirrored the breakup that she was going through with her husband, Jacques Demy. And again, she was using her life as, you know, taking a page out of her own life. She cast her young son, who was probably five or six years old, in the film as the son of the editor, the filmmaker editor, who's the lead. Yeah, so the parallels to her own life are extremely close.
In Beaches, she mentions something that I guess was new to most people, which is that Demy died of AIDS. Was he gay?
Bisexual, certainly, yeah. That was a fact that was disclosed in that film, and that I think Varda was trying to maybe protect her son or others in the family for a period of time. Demy and Varda grew apart for a period. They then, at the end of Demi's life, he came back into Varda's world and to the family. And she made this very beautiful pair of works, Jacques de Nantes, a narrative film about Jacques Demy's life as a filmmaker. And also the other film that Varda made was The Magical World of Jacques Demy, a documentary about Jacques Demy.
You've been listening to an interview with Susan Oxtoby of BAMFA, Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive, about the life of filmmaker Agnes Varda, a definitive biography, Complicated Passion, The Life and Work of Agnes Varda, has recently been published. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves. Book Waves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
This is Daffodil. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland.
I got troubles. I got them too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. We stick together, can see it through, 'cause you got a friend in me.
Hey there, relatives. We missed you, and I know you missed us. Rosity Native Radio is returning to the airwaves starting May 15th. Nick and I will be back in the saddle again to bring you all the Indigenous news, music, and more. So stay tuned, 90.7 FM, Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Have him on my whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver stream. Can't tell them apart at all.
Now I'm good. My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Charlotte Ameringer. She's the chief conservator at the Portland Art Museum, and Charlotte is here talking about Monet's Floating Worlds at Giverny, Portland's Water Lilies Resurfaces, which is on now through August the 10th, 2025. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus for the first time, Charlotte.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
So, Charlotte, you restored the Water Lilies, which is Portland's premier painting, really. It's a Claude Monet from around 1914, and it's a very big, almost square, blue and green painting of a pond surface. So we're looking at water lilies in with greenish blue flowers and then pink flowers. You restored this over the last kind of year, and now it's up with an exhibition that also explains the context of the painting and the Japanese influence on Monet. What was the significance of this painting in your career? What was it like working with a Monet? And then what was your brief? What did they tell you to do?
So I would say definitely this is a highlight of my career. So I arrived at the museum in 2022, just in time for the deinstallation of many of the galleries in preparation for our big construction project. And one of the things I was asked to do was to go through the paintings collection. And I should backtrack a little bit and say that my specialty is paintings conservation. and identify paintings in the collection that would benefit the most from treatment. And one of the works that I kept coming back to was water lilies, because I knew that it didn't look the way that it should. Mm-hmm. So it didn't look the way that Monet intended it to look. And the main reason for that is that it had a varnish on it. And I knew that Monet was very adamant and vocal about the fact that paintings from this period should not be varnished. Mm-hmm. And when you varnish a painting, you pretty significantly change the way that it looks. Mm-hmm. So I identified this painting as something that should be treated, and the opportunity with a lot of the galleries closing was a great opportunity to take such a beloved painting off view. Mm-hmm.
Did you do a lot of other paintings at this time?
Yes, so we're going through lists of artworks that the curators have identified that will go back on view when the museum reopens. Mm-hmm. And identifying those things that need conservation treatment.
Was it mostly oil paintings with varnish that shouldn't be there?
It's a variety of conservation issues that paintings have. Mm-hmm. So that is definitely a typical reason that paintings will come to the studio mm-hmm. for conservation treatment.
So things like fading, dust, nicotine, smoke, other kinds of changes that happen over the lifetime of the painting.
Yes, so we kind of divide them into two main categories. So they're aesthetic issues, which are things like accumulated surface grime or a yellowed varnish or a varnish that shouldn't be there. And then, of course, there's structural concerns. So things like paint that's flaking or insecure or other structural issues.
Mm-hmm. So this painting, the paint was actually okay. It was really just the varnish was the problem.
Correct. It was pretty much completely an aesthetic treatment. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about the way it looks now compared to when you got your hands on it last year.
So two main things, and probably the most obvious thing that will come to mind when people think of a varnish, is that it imparts a glossiness or a sheen and shine to the surface of a painting, and so removal of that varnish changes the way that light reflects and scatters off the surface of that painting. And then the second aspect, which for a work like this really is almost more important from the way that it looks, is that a varnish does something which we call saturation. So it saturates the colors, mm-hmm. so it makes the colors look darker, it makes them look deeper, it will accentuate the like dark contrast between those colors. And a painting like this Water Lilies painting that has so many blues in it, so blues are one of the colors that is most affected by a change in saturation when you apply a varnish to it. So the removal of that varnish really changed the tonalities in the work. Mm-hmm. And so we know Monet saying, basically starting in around the 1870s, that what he wants is this very pastel-like surface. And if you mm-hmm. have the chance to go see paintings from this late period, or especially that beautiful cycle of mural paintings that's at the Orangerie in Paris, you'll see that beautiful matte pastel-like surface, and that is really mm-hmm. what this painting was missing. And so that's what we've recovered. We've recovered that surface, but we've also recovered those really beautiful, very subtle tonal shifts that were there that the varnish just obliterated.
Mm-hmm. If you look at the painting, there's a lot of light blue. I'd say the sort of left half of the painting is light blue. The
yes.
right half is mostly greens. There's a sort of dabbed and daubed kind of brush work, almost a bit dry. There's not a lot of paint on it, letting you see purples and white beneath the surface or in the background. Now, were you saying all that was harder to see with the varnish?
Exactly, yes. So you could maybe see the whites and the darker blues, but what you couldn't see is all those really subtle transitions in between. And the other interesting thing that I learned in the course of my research is just how important the actual brushwork and the viewer's physical experience of that surface texture and the texture of the brushwork was to Monet, and that he wanted sort of this almost visceral, sort of palpable experience of the painting to be part of the viewer's experience. Mm-hmm. The actual brushwork itself and the actual texture of the mm-hmm. painting. So
if you look at it, the lilies, the flowers are all thick, yes, and stand out, you know, several millimeters from the surface. They're bright reds, pinks, yellows, you know, different blues and purples and greens. But the background, the water and the lilies, is a lot flatter.
It is flatter than the lily blossoms themselves, but if you look at it sort of a bit from the side, it's not as built up as some of his other paintings. So if you think to the Haystacks or the Rouen Cathedral paintings, which have that really thick encrusted paint, but if you sort of start to look at the way he's layering his brush strokes, for example, if you look at these purple outlines
on the left side
that are meant to indicate the lily pads themselves, you begin to see that the brush strokes sort of skip mm-hmm. and create this sort of scattered brush stroke. Mm-hmm. And one of the art historians has dubbed this corrugation, because if you can imagine, it looks like you took a paintbrush and sort of struck it across a piece of corrugated cardboard.
Yeah.
And so what you're seeing is paint being dragged across a buildup of textured paint. Mm-hmm. And so this is why I'm kind of saying that texture was really important to Monet. Right. And your experience of that texture is just as important to him as your experience of the color. And in some ways, almost your experience of the subject matter takes a back seat to your experience of the color and the brushwork and mm-hmm. the textures. Mm-hmm. Like he's really evolving into this very, for his time, avant-garde space of painting. And that's partially why these paintings were not very well received in their day, and it really isn't until, I think it's 1957 or 58, when MoMA in New York City buys one of these late Monet paintings that other institutions start collecting them.
Really?
Yes. So they kind of languish first in Monet's studio and then in the collection of his son, Michel Monet, because they're really not appreciated by the wider public.
Mm-hmm. So Monet, he was mature when he did his water lilies, the last section.
Yes.
And he built this pond in Giverny. He had gardeners looking after it, you know, it was all kind of like a set so he could do painting. And he'd done easel size, mostly small paintings of water lilies, and then he went big. At the end of his life, he did this big series of giant paintings, but this one here in Portland is the first experimenting in a bigger size. Is that right?
It is one of the first. So in 1911, Monet's second wife dies. And then in 1914, Monet's eldest son, Jean, dies. And he goes into this period of really deep mourning. And so for about 2-3 years, he really doesn't paint at all. And it isn't until sort of midway through 1914 that he picks up paint and palette again and starts painting. And what brings him to this point where he wants to paint again is this idea that sort of has been percolating in his mind for quite some time, and it's this idea of painting this grand cycle of what will evolve into that mural cycle that's in Paris. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is he's 73 when he paints our painting or starts to paint it. He's feeling his age. He's feeling like he wants to leave a legacy. And the other part of it is just the effects of the war. And what he wants to do is create a gift for the state of France. And it's also kind of, you can see it as a war memorial. Mm-hmm. And so he starts painting these much larger canvases. And he starts, if you've ever been a painter yourself, painting on a small scale and painting on a big scale, they're very different things. So he starts kind of working out like how he's going to do this. And our painting is among the very first where he's trying to work this out. And one of the really lovely things is, so Monet kept our painting when he passed away. The painting went to his surviving son, Michel. And Michel had this painting hanging in his dining room until 1959, when he sold it through a dealer to the Portland Art Museum. And it was a really valued painting because it's such a successful painting. And I think Monet recognized that, his son recognized that. Mm-hmm. And we know Monet destroyed many, many paintings.
Right.
So it makes it a really special painting. And our curator is always really good at pointing out, like, if you see a catalog of paintings from this period or a show from this period, almost always our painting will be highlighted as the cover of the catalog banners, because it
even though you can't buy it.
Yeah, it is really recognized as sort of one of the most exemplary examples of paintings from the late period.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Charlotte Amaringa. She's the chief conservator at the Portland Art Museum. Charlotte's talking about Monet's Floating Worlds at Giverny, Portland's Water Lilies resurfaces. There is an exhibition accompanying this which shows a lot of the Japanese influence on the Impressionists, and particularly on Monet, who was, you know, pretty avid collector of Japanese prints. Could you say a little bit about the composition? So we're looking at a pond. At first glance, you might think, oh, there is a skyline. You know, there are like poplar trees on the edge of the lake. And we're looking at water, we're looking at sky. But it's really not. It's just zooming in on water. And some of the blue is a reflection of the sky. What else is in the painting?
Yeah, so really interestingly, as you mentioned, Monet is a really avid collector of Japanese prints, and if you had walked into his home in Giverny, you would have been greeted by a room filled with Japanese prints, and that's what we have tried to recreate in that first gallery where you walk in. We've used a similar yellow to what was in his dining room. And we've used similar prints to what he had collected. And while he didn't exactly copy or sort of, he didn't specifically use direct elements from Japanese prints, he definitely sort of incorporated their aesthetic. So one of the main things you can see is this cropping in of a subject. And another thing you can see is these really different viewpoints to sort of typical Western things, and a very different use of perspective. So this painting, there is no horizon line, and really everything you're looking at is reflection. Mm-hmm. And there's no way you could see what you see in this painting if you stood in one place. So you have one viewpoint for the pink water lilies, and the white ones, you would have to go stand somewhere different to actually see that viewpoint. So he's kind of presenting you with this almost disorienting perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think also what he's borrowing from Japanese prints is that really calligraphic stroke. So instead of trying to present something through sort of form and shading and shadow, it's just through simple shape.
So a lot of the water lilies are just these rough ovals on their sides, sort of horizontal ovals. What are the tall streaks of green in the middle and at the top right?
So those are willows. So he had a lot of weeping willows in his garden. And it's a little disorienting because we're seeing them in reflection. Mm-hmm. So they're actually upside down.
Yeah. So these are dangling sort of strands of willow hanging over the pond.
Exactly, yes. Mm-hmm. And then some of the other vegetation that you're seeing are other trees that are being reflected, that are on the sides of the pond, but they're being reflected in the pond. Mm-hmm. And we can kind of make an assumption that maybe it's like early in the morning or later in the evening, and that we have a little bit of a glow of mm-hmm. sunrise or sunset because of the pinks and purple.
So I know he took from the Japanese the idea that if you keep painting a place over and over, you end up painting the weather conditions and the light conditions and, you know, this impression you get. He also took something else in this idea of the floating world, like, and I don't understand it. It's something to do with when you're looking at an object, you're not really seeing the object, you're seeing your own relation to the object in time. Is that correct?
So, yeah, that's one of the really interesting things, and I don't know that I understand it really either, but he had this fascination with capturing a moment in time, and the Impressionists, in addition to embracing these philosophies, they were also embracing new scientific theories. So at this point in time, there was a scientific theory that color traveled in waves through a medium that was called the ether. And so Monet was really fascinated with this concept of capturing what he called the ether or the envelope. Mm-hmm. And by that, he meant the light that was traveling to him through the ether and capturing that on canvas. Mm-hmm. And that meant that at any one moment in time, everything was different and changed. So you really were capturing this one moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was, I mean, that was a radical idea at the time. Why did he stick at the water lilies idea for so long? What do you know what the attraction was for the pond and, water and the vegetation? I did read that the willows sort of symbolize a kind of mourning, you know, that is connected to the First World War, you know, in his later thinking. Do you know what the attraction of the pond was?
I guess I've come to see it a lot as it's an escape for him, that he doesn't have to deal with all the atrocities going on in the world. I read a number of biographies about him mm-hmm. while I was working on this painting, and there comes a point where I think he and one other person are the only ones left, even in the town of Giverny. Everyone else has evacuated, and war actually comes really close to his doorstep, and he just refuses to leave. And mm-hmm. I think just the fact of his son dying and many other people he knows and their children dying, like, it's his escape and his way of dealing with what is going on in the world.
Mm-hmm. Should we look at some of the Japanese prints?
Sure.
So, Charlotte, in the rest of the exhibition, there are a lot of Japanese prints that of the type that Monet would have collected. They're from the Portland Art Museum's collection. And there's one of a wave on a beach with Fuji in the background, and it's by Hiroshige. What is this print, and why is it here?
Yeah, so we worked very closely with our Asian curator, Jeanne Kanmatsu, who we were able to find some prints that are exactly the print that Monet owned. We were able to find other prints that are prints from the same series that Monet owned, and then other prints basically are prints that are sort of in the spirit of prints that Monet owned. And this wave print that we are looking at sort of falls in that last category of prints. We do own the exact print that Monet owned, but it was exhibited in an earlier exhibition of Japanese prints that we had up about 2 years ago. And because these prints use inks and other sorts of materials that are light sensitive, when they have been shown a certain period of time, they have to go dark for a certain period of time, or rest, as we would say in conservation speak, so that they can be shown again later. Otherwise, if we keep showing them, we sort of exhaust them and their lifespan is much shorter. Oh, okay. So this print is up sort of in place of that. So we have a wave print, but not the exact wave print.
So this would have faded if you'd, the other one would have faded if you'd left it out longer.
It fades at a much more accelerated rate. So in conservation, our goal is that your grandkids could come to the museum and be able to see, so you know, the collection in the same way that you are able to. So we are stewards of a collection that we hold in trust for the community, and we don't want to sort of use up that collection on one generation, but we're trying to hold it in trust for many, many years to come.
Couldn't you put a varnish on it?
On this? No.
Can you do anything to save it from fading?
What we do to save it from fading is we stick it in dark storage.
let's just take one more look at Water Lilies by Claude Monet. The effect now, as somebody walks in, it's a lot lighter than it was, right?
Yes.
The blues are lighter and more distinct.
Yes.
Did the pinks and the bluey-green blossoms, did they change color?
They did not change as much, but I would say their relationship to the rest of the painting definitely changed.
Would they pop?
They probably pop less because the blues are less saturated now, so they're brought into the relationship that Monet wanted for them. I advocated to have this painting shown in lighting that approximates daylight. So if you look around the gallery, you'll notice that the lights on the water lilies looks a little bit different than it does in other parts of the gallery. And I did that intentionally because this painting was painted partially out of doors. Mm-hmm. You'll see there's a photograph to the right of the painting that shows Monet painting out of doors. And so I felt it was important to show the painting in that same lighting.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else about the painting you think people should know before they come back and see the water lilies in Portland?
Yeah, one thing that was really important to me, and because this is such an important painting in our collection, is to undertake this conservation treatment in a very transparent manner. And so I applied to Bank of America has a conservation grant program, and I applied to them and received a grant to be able to produce a series of videos so people can go to the museum's website and see these videos, and it basically will take you through the conservation process so you can understand why we had to do conservation, what our thinking was. You can watch me do the conservation process. You can follow along. You can see before and after.
I saw the video of you basically wiping the surface very so carefully over several months. Is that mostly what you did, was remove varnish? You didn't have to fill in any cracks or, you know, change the canvas around?
Yeah, no, that was probably 98% of what I did. There was a very small damage in the upper left and a second small damage, so I did a very small amount of in-painting, but really it was all about getting that varnish off the surface.
Mm-hmm. So now when you go to a contemporary art gallery in, say, New York, where they have the finest, you know, care and the most modern materials, are people or collectors still making mistakes today that will have to be undone in 50 or 100 years?
So I guess I look at it as that artists really should do whatever it is they want to do, and it's kind of the conservator's job to figure out how to get those materials as far into the future as possible. Mm-hmm. I'll say they're definitely materials in use now that have a lifespan. So like oil paintings will last many hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. There are materials that artists are using now that I think when museums acquire them, they just have to understand that they have a finite lifespan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Charlotte Amaringa. She's the chief conservator at the Portland Art Museum. Charlotte was talking about Monet's Floating Worlds at Giverny, Portland's Water Lilies Resurfaces, and it's on now through August the 10th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Charlotte.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Andy, mon, now, whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver stream. Can't tell them apart at all.
Está sintonizando KDOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.
Hoy martes 6 de mayo del 2025.